Good morning again. So, who's this dude on the front of your bulletin? His name, as the top of your bulletin says, is named Karl von Clausewitz. He was a general in the Prussian army in the early 19th century. He wrote a book called Vom Kriege, which loosely translated into English means on war. I'm told it's standard reading if you go to war college. It's that prevalent and persistent. He had that much insight. And yet there's a phrase that he coined that has far outlasted his memory. And it's in the quote on the front of your bulletin also. He said of war this: "War is an area of uncertainty. Three quarters of the things on which all action in war is based are lying in a fog of uncertainty to a greater or lesser extent. The first thing needed here is a fine, piercing mind to feel out the truth with the measure of its judgment." The phrase that has persisted has been the fog of war. There was even a documentary that came out a few years ago about Robert McNamara and his experience in the Vietnam War and how that experience persists. It's the idea, as von Clausewitz puts it, that when war happens, most of the decisions that you're making are entirely, almost practically blind. That there are so many things at work in real time that you can't account for, that unless you work with all your might and strength to see reality as best as you can, you will become a liability, if not a casualty. Because war happens and a fog descends on those who are participating, whether they're frontline soldiers or rear guard generals. We're in a series on Galatians, and the letter that Paul is writing to the fledgling churches of Galatia, they're having the experience of a sort of a fog that's descended upon them in their own struggle to know what one must do or believe to find the favor of God. They have become confused because they've heard one thing from the Apostle Paul, and then they've heard something quite different from another set of teachers after he'd left. They're in a fog, and they're in a fight to know what's true about what it means to be in the favor of God. Now, all of that might sound pretty arcane and very first century and kind of in a different world, but brothers and sisters, I'm going to suggest to you this morning by way of argument that their struggle is your struggle. That you too, whether you are aware of it most of the time or not, are in a kind of a fog of uncertainty. An uncertainty about whether the life that you're living really matters, whether the road you're on is leading you to anything bright, or if you are just bound for regret. Because there is a sinking feeling in every one of us from time to time that the amount of effort we put into pursuing the things that we do and the degree of disappointment we feel and the things that don't pan out, that maybe there's something deeper at work, more than just the aspirations or the disappointments themselves. Maybe it's because we're concerned about something deeper than just the moment we're in. That's the fog that we're in. And brothers and sisters, sometimes it feels like a war. What the Apostle Paul is going to argue is that what the Galatians need to see is what you and I need to see. And what they and we need to see has to do, first and foremost, with the promise that God has made. And we're going to talk about three things from this text that have to do with the promise of God. One, the precedence of the promise. Two, the perils of rejecting it. And three, the practice of applying it. The precedence of the promise, the perils of rejecting it, and the practice of applying it. We're in Galatians, we're in chapter 3, we're starting in verse 15. Would you stand as we read? Galatians 3, starting in verse 15. "To give a human example, brothers, even with a man-made covenant, no one annuls it or adds to it once it's been ratified. Now, the promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring, and it doesn't say "and to offsprings," referring to many, but referring to one, and to your offspring, who is Christ. This is what I mean. The law, which came 430 years afterward, does not annul a covenant previously ratified by God so as to make the promise void. For if the inheritance comes by the law, it no longer comes by a promise. But God gave it to Abraham by a promise. Why then the law? It was added because of transgressions, until the offspring should come to whom the promise has been made. And it was put in place through angels by an intermediary. Now, an intermediary implies more than one, but God is one. Is the law then contrary to the promises of God? Certainly not. For if a law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law. But the scripture imprisoned everything under sin, so that the promise by faith in Jesus Christ might come, might be given to those who believe. Now, before faith came, we were held captive under the law, imprisoned until the coming faith would be revealed. So then, the law was our guardian until Christ came, in order that we might be justified by faith. But now that faith has come, we are no longer under a guardian. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God. You may be seated. We're in that section of Paul's letter when he's getting down to brass tacks as to why the good news that he has brought to them about Jesus has to reign in their hearts and minds. It has to go deeper than just a cerebral cognitive understanding. And as we've said in past weeks, Paul is up against something. He's up against an influence that had come to infiltrate the Galatian church in that time, and which had cast a certain lack of credibility upon his message and his authority to offer a message. After Paul had left those churches, after he'd planted them, gotten them off the ground, other Jewish teachers who believed in Jesus had come to those churches and had begun to insist something at odds with what Paul had been teaching. They began to insist that to be in the full blessing and favor of God, not only did you have to believe that Jesus was the king of this new kingdom, but that you had to scrupulously follow every element and detail about what the Mosaic law had taught. And so Paul is, if you will, in a fight. In a fight for the Galatian churches, and more specifically, a fight for their understanding of what the law is, with a view to understanding what really brings one into the favor of God. The Galatians are therefore in a fog. How should they think about the law? And to help them see through that fog, Paul is saying that they need to see something that takes precedence even more so than the law. And that thing that takes precedence is the promise of God. Now, what do we mean by the promise of God? It's not a generic term. It has great specificity, and it has a historical referent to it, as well as a historical fullness to it. When Paul talks about promise and covenant, he's using those two words interchangeably. You heard them both in the first section of the passage. And as he did in the passage that we looked at last week, Paul is talking about the promise that was made to Abraham. You don't need to turn there now, but if you want to look this afternoon in Genesis 12, in Genesis 15, in Genesis 17, those are all the places in which God articulates a promise to Abraham where he says in as many words, I'm going to birth a nation through you, Abraham. I'm going to bless a nation from you, Abraham, and I'm going to bless that nation so that it will be a blessing unto every nation of the earth, period. That's the promise. Paul is not raising that promise simply for being historically comprehensive, though. The reason he brings up that promise to Abraham is to show that that kind of promise that God makes to Abraham would only be appropriated by faith alone. That it's Abraham's trust in what God had said that God says, I will find you righteous in my sight, and the promise I made is a promise I'll keep. Abraham doesn't have to prove himself to God. He doesn't have to prove himself worthy of that promise. He just had to trust that God would keep his word. And that's why in Genesis 15:6 it says, Abraham believed and it was counted to him as righteousness, i.e. a right standing with God by faith alone. Where Paul elaborates on that theme in our passage is this. That promise that God makes to Abraham that would be appropriated by faith alone is going to be fulfilled through Jesus. Jesus is the most important person to come through the line of Abraham, and through him shall the full blessing of Abraham come, not just to Israel, but to all the nations. This is a promise of life. Not just existence, not just survival, not just struggling through in a way of quiet way of desperation, life. An aliveness to God, an awareness of his presence, and a glorying in that. It's a promise of life. It's also a promise of inheritance. You heard the word inheritance in the first paragraph of the passage. That inheritance is shorthand for saying that something of great value comes to all those who walk in the way that Abraham did by faith. To Abraham, when he would hear the word inheritance, he would know that that meant land, posterity, blessing, and mission. To us who know about Jesus, we know that that inheritance means all of that, but also life without end. Though ye die, yet shall ye live. It's a promise fulfilled through Jesus. It's a promise received by faith in Jesus. And with respect to Paul's concern, it's a promise that has to take precedence in the Galatians' minds if they're ever going to understand the law. Now, bear with me. That's a lot, and I've got to do just a little bit more in the way of groundwork. I've got to let you know what Paul is saying so that I can help you understand why it matters that you get it. There are four reasons that Paul gives why the promise of God through Abraham takes precedence in their thinking over the law. And the first one is this. It came before the law. He references a date, a chronology. That promise to Abraham came 430 years before Moses goes up Sinai and receives the Ten Commandments and then becomes the beneficiary and the recipient of all the law thereafter. Just as we think of a last will and testament, that does not change. It is binding. It is irrevocable. You don't add codicils or amendments unless the testator himself makes the change. God is the testator of the promise to Abraham. And when God gives the law to Moses, 430 years later, it is not as if God is saying, okay, that part about Abraham, scratch that. Never mind. I'm starting over. That promise to Abraham still is in effect. And so Paul is saying, in other words, if God's promise of his presence to Abraham came first and it was appropriated by faith, then this law of Moses comes along, doesn't change that situation. That's the first reason why the promise takes precedence. The rest of the reasons about why the law takes, if you will, sort of second fiddle to the promise is because the law has certain limitations in and of itself. Even though we've sung this day about how the law is good and worthy and lovely and like sweetness of the honeycomb, it has certain limitations that we all have to get our hands around. And what Paul says in verse 19 is that the law has a limitation in the sense that it was only added in the way of transgression. What does that mean? It means that the law was instituted by God to show one thing, that all sin is ultimately a sin against God. When King David, who ascends to the throne, who is blessed by God, commits adultery with Bathsheba, collaborates in deceit with his commanders, commits murder against the husband of Bathsheba, it's in Psalm 51 that he realizes that despite all of those sins against other parties, he realizes all of those sins are ultimately against God. Because they're all fundamentally, first of all, a mistrust of God. And so the football player that hit his wife in the elevator, that's a sin. His efforts to conceal it was another sin. If it's true that the league really did try to conceal their knowledge of it to protect the brand and not impact the bottom line, that's a sin. If it's his wife's commitments to say to him only because she doesn't want the gravy train to end, that's a sin. But brothers and sisters, if you and I look on him only with scorn, and we think ourselves immune from the same sort of impulses, forgetting that Jesus said that if you hate another person, it's equivalent to murder, then that's our sin. And until we see it as such, that it's sin against him, we don't see sin aright. We needed the law to show us the seriousness of that. Paul's already anticipating some pushback when he starts articulating why the law has certain limitations to it. Why the law at all, people would begin to wonder. And the last two reasons why the law takes second banana to the promise are these. The promise has precedence because the law's ultimate purpose was actually to show that we're all really captive to sin. In verses 21 and 22, he says, is the law contrary to the promises of God? Certainly not. If a law had been given that could give life, then righteousness would indeed be by the law. But the scripture imprisoned everything under sin. Paul is saying the law is like a CT scanner. It has an astounding capacity to diagnose what is wrong. It has an amazing ability to show you what health looks like. But it's not a remedy. A law can tell us what to do, what not to do. It can even explain and articulate and illustrate why obedience is right and why disobedience is wrong. But it can't motivate the heart sustainably to do what it asks any more than a doctor can bring a cure. Something has to occur from within the heart if the heart is ever going to be healed in its temptation against sin. The law's got a limit. The law comes after the promise. It's put in place to show the severity of sin. It's there to show the ubiquity and inescapability of sin. And finally, the reason why we have to think of the law in a subservient status to the promise is this. The law, Paul says, was meant only as a kind of temporary custodian of your life. In the ESV, it translates it guardian. In other translations, it refers to it as a tutor. And as I said, the Psalms will extol the law fervently. Even our sharing of the peace said, it's so good, it brings us peace. The Psalms rightly praise the law. But the idea that Paul's bringing forth is that the law had something of a provisional role. It was meant to rein us in, to keep us from hurting ourselves and one another. And that's why the law still has a lingering role and perspective and relevance to our existence. C.S. Lewis, in his last novel, Till We Have Faces, speaks of sort of a homely young girl who is the daughter of a king. Her name is Arul. She has an even lovelier younger sister by the name of Psyche. It's a retelling of the Greek myth, Cupid and Psyche, right? She is raised by a slave from Greece who's known as the fox. And she loves him, but he's stoic and materialist and belittles any talk of her ever believing that there's something more to this world than that which we can see and taste and feel. But there is a moment where she asks him, are the gods not just? And the fox says, oh no, child, what would become of us if they were? The law of God is like the fox in that it can only show us that if we're ever going to get by, we're going to need something other than the law's justice. We're going to need mercy because justice is only going to end up condemning us. It's the law, Paul says, that in the end actually confirms that our only hope of ever being in right standing with God is going to have to be by faith in a promise that we don't have to prove our worth, but that we're going to have to just take God at His word. The promise of God's commitment to us, the steadfast love for us, has to take precedence in our thinking if we're ever to understand the law. Okay, thank you for bearing with me. That was a lot. It's time to ask the question, why is he putting so much emphasis on understanding the law in this context? Why would basing your sense on God's favor, on your compliance with the law, be such a matter of significance to Paul? And for that matter, why should you care? I will tell you. Just as the Galatians were tempted to establish their own acceptance on their compliance with the law rather than God's promise to them, you and I, and every human, has two options in this world when it comes to finding our own sense of acceptance. You will either base your meaning, your identity, your hope, and your acceptance on the promise that God has made to you in Jesus, or you will try to establish it on your own terms, by your own light, through your own effort, and on your own definition. Joseph Piper is an author of the last century. He wrote a book on leisure, and he said that this is true of man, that man seems to mistrust everything that is effortless. He can only enjoy with a good conscience what he has acquired with toil and trouble. He refuses to have anything as a gift. You get that because you live that. I do, and that's instinctual to us. Unless we make it, we build it, we show it, we can't trust it. Anything's good's going to come to us. But brothers and sisters, what Paul is saying is that if you let the most fundamental identity and hope come from what you think you can build, then there are perils to which you subject yourself. My second and thankfully shorter point is to say that there are real, alive, and dangerous perils of rejecting the promise of God. The peril is you become a menace. You become a menace to yourself and to everyone around you. And if we want to keep with the sort of wartime military motif, you will become a liability in your war until you become a casualty in it. You will become your own worst enemy if you walk by the promise of God in order to establish your own sense of acceptance. So, what are the perils? You will become a menace to yourself by setting yourself up for frustration. What do I mean? You and I are on a path. We're all aspiring to different things. We all want things. We all want to do things. We want to get to certain things. You know, that's natural and it's normal. It's even healthy. We should have goals. We should have dreams. We should have objectives that we set for us. But if you place those aspirations in the role of the basis for the very meaning of your life, of what makes you acceptable, then the normal and natural vicissitudes of life is only going to heap frustration upon your heart. You can't predict the future, much less control it. We're all going to experience frustrations. Paul will elsewhere say in Romans 8 that God has subjected the creation to frustration. It's unavoidable. There is no frictionless plane. But if you enthrone whatever you're doing as that which you think will crown you as king of your world, if you are demanding that life turn out in a certain way, if you are demanding that your children turn out in a certain way, if you are demanding in your heart that your 401k be of a certain size by a certain time, if that's your ultimate hope, then you have asked for frustration. You have put a target on your back. Life is full of disappointments. It's unavoidable. But if you make that which you're disappointed in as the key to your happiness, you've set yourself up for great despair. Let's take a more optimistic view for just a second, though. Let's say you get to where you want to be. Let's say you get to where you want to go. Let's say you've got what you want. If that's what you thought made you acceptable, then you've only set yourself up for anxiety. Why anxiety? Because now you've got to do everything you can to make sure it doesn't go away. In the same vein as the previous point, life being what it is, everything changes, often unexpectedly. You get sick, you get fired, you get old, you get cheated, defrauded, defunded. All of that can happen. All of it does happen. All of it will happen. If something determines your sense of glory other than the promise that you're accepted by God and that what you have from Him is everlasting and better than anything you'll ever get here, then you are only going to know anxiety. You will feed on it. And it will fuel you for a while. Third, not only do you set yourself up for frustration and for anxiety, you also set yourself up for an inclination to walk away from integrity. What do I mean? If who you believe yourself to be, ultimately, is something other than what God tells you are through His promise, if you are out to make a name for yourself apart from the name that He gives you, then you are more likely to be the kind of person that will conceal your errors, your blunders, your offenses, and your weaknesses. You won't share them because you're terrified not only of people knowing them, but of how you think it will compromise your ability to get where you want or how you want to be known. You won't face it. You won't deal with it. You won't own it. If God is your promise, then your failures, while regrettable, will not be so important that you can't admit them. But if you are your own promise, then you will lie to yourself and everyone else. All of this is how you become a menace to yourself if you let something other than the promise of God rule your heart. But like an atom bomb, there's fallout, and there is a blast radius. And it doesn't just affect where the bomb went off. It goes far afield. You become a menace to yourself. You become a menace to others. You become a curse to others in another sense. What do I mean? If you believe that the source of your frustrations in finding your acceptance is the people in your life, then you've put a target on them and you've turned them into a de facto enemy. It can be a spouse, it can be a child, it can be a parent, it can be a colleague. They are all potential targets of your wrath if you think they are what's in the way of you ever becoming okay with yourself. Relationships are inevitably going to inconvenience you. That's the nature of relationships. There's no way around it. But if you make your efforts the way to your acceptance, to the extent that you're inconvenienced by them is the extent to which you are prone to hurling insults and invective at them. And that's just one example of how making something else your acceptance will lead you to not do right by people. If something else is your acceptance, you will never do the hard thing of confronting someone else in love if you think their acceptance of you is what makes you acceptable. You will never enjoy, much less celebrate, those who demonstrate more aptitude than you because you think it's all about you. You will never help those whom you think might soon exceed you in the eyes of others' approval because you think it's all about you. You know people like this. You might be people like this. I'm people like this. And doesn't not all come back to where you find that one thing that you think most determines your worth? Letting that worth come from anywhere else doesn't mean that you're going to fall into all those perils, but it sure sets you up for the fall. So, how do we let the promise that takes precedence, how do we make sure that it takes precedence so that we don't fall into the perils? That's my last point. Let's talk about practicing the promise. The promise that's made to Abraham, that's fulfilled through Jesus so that blessing would come to Jew and Gentile alike, is something that we must believe. But implicit within the nature of belief is the idea of practice. How do you practice the promise? When you start noticing that you're grinding your teeth or that your stomach is in churning, or that your temper is flaring more often than not, these are not just moments of intense emotion. they're not just moments of weakness. Brothers and sisters, there's actually opportunities for practicing the promise. It may be more than this kind of practice, but it's certainly not less than it. It's three things. To practice the promise, you first have to remember the promise. You have to think about it. Taking the thought and basting your brain like a turkey with the notion that who you are to God and what you have from Him makes the pursuit of everything else you do not unimportant, but just not as important as what He is to you and what He's done for you. That's remembering it. That's remembering the promise. If Jesus died to be your pardon and to secure God's favor and to earmark you for an inheritance that can never be taken, then those mind-boggling ideas have to boggle your mind. And the only way they'll boggle them is if you think about them. They're received by faith, but they become potent in part through thinking about them. They also become potent by praying through them. Praying a prayer like this: Father, I struggle to trust that you have my best interests at heart, that you're even there. Hear my cry. Help me to trust in what I cannot see, and yet what the resurrection of Jesus certainly warrants a belief in. Short prayer, from which you can elaborate at length. You got to think about the promise. You got to pray through the promise, and then you actually have to act as if it's true. The life of faith is not easy. You and I know that, but it's also not obscure. What do I mean by that? You don't have to guess what it would look like for you to treat others and pursue your aspirations in light of the promise of the gospel. Peace is always going to be in order, even if the circumstances are militating against it. Kindness will always be in order, even if you're being treated unkindly. Hope will always be in order, even if in an instant, the light of your life falls out of your life. You know what it will look like to walk in faith. Practicing the promise is doing what you know the promise calls you to do, even if you walk unsteadily in it. And you will. Your heart will have to catch up. And that sounds almost too trite, a three-step plan to practicing the promise of God. But that practice is practiced preemptively and repentantly. You do it before you sin, and you do it in the wake of your sin. And while it is in fact a personal act, it is never not a communal act too. You'll need each other to practice that promise. But let me see if I can rescue it from a too simplistic nature. I want to read to you a longish quote to kind of close things out, which kind of breaks all sermonic rules. You're not supposed to read long quotes, but this one was a gimme. This one was a worth one. To set it up, I'll just say this. Many of you know the history of a man named Jim Elliot. His wife is Elizabeth Elliot. Jim Elliot and four of his comrades went to Ecuador to evangelize the Waorani tribe. And in January of 1956, they were murdered at the hands of those tribesmen. Helen Johnson, a member of our church, her late husband Don, was commissioned to be the search party to recover Jim Elliot and the other four's bodies. Elizabeth Elliot wrote a book reflecting upon that experience of having lost her husband in the effort to evangelize a tribe. And in her book, Through the Gates of Splendor, she wrote this: "There is always the urge to oversimplify, to weigh in at once with interpretations that cannot possibly cover all the data or stand up to close inspection. We know, for example, that time and again in the history of the Christian church, the blood of martyrs has been its seed. And so we are tempted to assume a simple equation here. Five men died. That will mean an X number of Waorani Christians. Well, perhaps so. Perhaps not. Cause and effect are in God's hands. God is God. I dethrone Him in my heart if I demand that He act in ways that satisfy my idea of justice. And there is unbelief, even rebellion, in the attitude that says, God has no right to do this to five men unless fill in the blank. Those men had long since given themselves without reservation to do the will of God. For us widows, the question as to why the men who had trusted God to be both shield and defender could be allowed to be speared to death was not one that could be smoothly or finally answered in 1956, nor even silenced in 1996. I believe with all my heart that God's story has a happy ending, but not yet. Not necessarily yet. It takes faith to hold on to that in the face of the great burden of experience, which seems to prove otherwise. What God means by happiness and goodness is a far higher thing than we can conceive. Let me finish her quote with this paragraph. Lean in. A healthier faith seeks a reference point outside of all human experience. The pole star, which marks the course of all human events, not forgetting that impenetrable mystery of the interplay of God's will and man's. We are sinners and we are buffoons. It's not the level of our spirituality that we can depend on. It is God and nothing less than God. For the work is God's and the call is God's and everything is summoned by Him into His purposes. We could have just read that and that would have been the sermon and that would have been enough. The promise of God, brothers and sisters, came from outside the world and outside human expectation and outside human experience. And therefore, as she puts it, the practice of the promise means we have to place our hopes outside human experience. Even as we both enjoy and suffer through human experience. In a fog, we need a beacon that we might not run aground. The promise of God in Jesus is that beacon. We're always going to be tempted to derive an identity from something other than the one God has given us through Jesus, but He will always be faithful to remind you that by His grace, you are His forever, even in a fog. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Amen.